The following program is a production of Sight and a Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the 13th reading of All the Light You Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. I'm Jim Abate. Before we begin, let me explain that the book is read in its entirety and that some of the reading may contain explicit descriptions that some people could find objectionable. For those of you who didn't hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. In our last reading, in January 1943, Werner found four more illegal transmissions. When they pass prisoners, Volkheimer challenges the largest among them and takes what clothes and boots fit him. Werner has not written to Jutta in many months. In St. Malo, the resistance, through Madame Rouet, asks Etienne to broadcast simple messages along with the numbers. The messages announced that so-and-so had a heart attack and died, birth announcements, and so forth. St. Malo is beginning to empty out. Madame Gibault and Blanchard have left. Von Rumpel, his treatments finished, found a second fake stone. In December 1943, Werner catches a fever and has horrible diarrhea. It lingers at least through February, but he continues to find illegal transmissions. Von Rumpel then finds the third fake stone, leaving only the real one to be found. The Germans believe a series of broadcasts is responsible for the destruction of a truck on a bridge, killing six Germans. Von Rumpel found Marie-Laure's apartment in Paris and the model of their neighborhood. In April 1944, Werner and his team are in Vienna, where he saw a seven-year-old girl playing on a swing, thought only of Jutta. Thinking he found another transmitter, they went to an apartment on the fourth floor, found no radio, but Neumann II shot and killed a woman and the seven-year-old girl Werner had seen playing, hiding in a closet. We now continue with All the Light We Cannot See. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. On the floor outside Marie-Laure's bedroom door waits something big wrapped in newsprint and twine. From the stairwell, Etienne says, "Happy 16th birthday." She tears away the paper, two books, one stacked atop the other. 3 years and 4 months have passed since Papa left St. Malo. 1,224 days. Almost 4 years have passed since she has felt Braille, and yet the letters rise from her memory as if she left off reading yesterday. Jules Verne, 20,000 Leagues, Part 1, Part 2. She throws herself at her great-uncle and hangs her arms around his neck. "You said you never got to finish. I thought rather than my reading it to you, maybe you could read it to me."
"But how?"
"Monsieur Ebrard, the bookseller."
"When nothing is available, and they're so expensive."
"You have made a lot of friends in this town, Marie-Laure." She stretches out on the floor and opens to the first page.
"I'm going to start it all over again, from the beginning."
"Perfect."
"Chapter 1," she reads, "A Shifting Reef. The year 1866 was marked by a strange event, an unexplainable occurrence, which is undoubtedly still fresh in everyone's memory."
She gallops through the first 10 pages, the story coming back. Worldwide curiosity about what must be a mythical sea monster. Famed marine biologist Professor Pierre Arnaud setting off to discover the truth. Is it monster or moving reef? Something else. Any page now, Arnaud will plunge over the rail of the frigate. Not long afterward, he and the Canadian harpooner Ned Land will find themselves on Captain Nemo's submarine. Beyond the carton-covered window, rain shifts down from a platinum-colored sky. A dove scrabbles along the gutter, calling, "Hoo, hoo, hoo!" Out in the harbor, a sturgeon makes a single leap like a silver horse, and then is gone. telegram. A new garrison commander has arrived on the Emerald Coast, a colonel. Trim, smart, efficient, won medals at Stalingrad, wears a monocle, invariably accompanied by a gorgeous French secretary interpreter who may or may not have consorted with Russian royalty. He is average size and prematurely gray, but by some contrivance of carriage and posture, he makes the men who stand before him feel smaller. The rumor is that this colonel ran an entire automobile company before the war, that he is a man who understands the power of the German soil, who feels its dark prehistoric vigor thudding in his very cells, that he will never acquiesce. Every night he sends telegrams from the district office in St. Malo. Among the 16 official communiques sent on the 30th of April, 1944, is a missive to Berlin. Notice of terrorist broadcasts in Côte d'Armor. We believe Saint Lunaire or Dinard or Saint Malo or Cancale request assistance to locate and eliminate. Dot, dot, dash, dash, off it goes into the wires belted across Europe. 8. 9 August 1944. Fort National. On the third afternoon of the siege of Saint Malo, the shelling lulls, as though all the artillerymen abruptly fell asleep at their guns. Trees burn, cars burn, houses burn, German soldiers drink wine in blockhouses. A priest in the college cellar scatters holy water on the walls. Two horses, gone mad with fear, kick through the door of the garage in which they've been shut and gallop between the smoldering houses on the Grand Rue. Around 4 o'clock, an American field howitzer 2 miles away lets fly a single improperly ranged shell. It sails over the city walls and bursts against the northern parapet of Fort National, where 380 Frenchmen are being held against their will with minimal cover. 9 are killed instantly, one of them still clutching the hand of bridge he was playing when the shell struck. In the attic. For all of Marie-Laure's 4 years in St. Malo, the bells of St. Vincent's have marked the hours, but now the bells have ceased. She does not know how long she has been trapped in the attic, or even if it is day or night. Time is a slippery thing. Lose hold of it once, and its string might sail out of your hands forever. Her thirst becomes so acute, she considers biting into her own arm to drink the liquid that courses there. She takes the cans of food from her great-uncle's coat and sets her lips on their rims. Both taste of tin, their contents just a millimeter away. "Don't risk it," says the voice of her father. "Don't risk the noise." "Just one, Papa. I will save the other. The German is gone. Almost certainly he is gone by now." "Why hasn't the tripwire sprung?" "Because he cut the wire, or I slept through the bell. Any of a half dozen other reasons. Why would he leave when what he seeks is here?" "Who knows what he seeks?" "You know what he seeks." "I am so hungry, Papa." "Try to think about something else." Roaring falls of clear, cool water. "You will survive, ma chérie." "How can you know?" "Because of the diamond in your coat pocket. Because I left it here to protect you. All it has done is put me in more danger." "Then why hasn't the house been hit? Why hasn't it caught fire?" "It's a rock, Papa, a pebble. There is only luck, bad or good, chance and physics, remember?" "You are alive." "I am only alive because I have not yet died." "Do not open the can. He will hear you. He will not hesitate to kill you." "How can he kill me if I cannot die?" Round and round the questions run. Marie-Laure's mind threatens to boil over. Just now she has pulled herself up onto the piano bench at the end of the attic and is running her hands over ATN's transmitter, trying to apprehend its switches and coils, hear the phonograph, hear the microphone, hear one of 4 leads connected to the pair of batteries, and when she hears something below her, a voice. Very carefully, she lowers herself off the bench and presses her ear to the floor. He is directly below her, urinating into the sixth-floor toilet, dribbling out a sad, intermittent trickle and groaning as though the process causes him torment. Between groans, he calls, "Das Hauschenfeld! Wo bist du Hauschen?" Something is wrong with him. "Das Hauschenfeld! Who bist du Hauschen?" No replies. Whom is he talking to? From somewhere beyond the house come the thump of distant mortars and the screech of shells hurtling overhead. She listens to the German move from the toilet towards her bedroom, limping that same limp, muttering, unhinged, "Hauschen. What does it mean?" The springs of her mattress creak. She would know that sound anywhere. Has he been sleeping in her bed all this time? 6 deep reports sound one after the other, deeper than anti-aircraft guns farther away, naval guns. Then come drums, cymbals, the gongs of explosions, drawing a crimson lattice over the roof. The lull is ending. Abyss in her gut, desert in her throat. Marie Laura takes one of the cans of food from her coat, the brick and the knife within reach. "Don't. If I keep listening to you, Papa, I will die of starvation with food in my hands." Her bedroom below remains quiet. The shells come patiently, each round whizzing over at a predictable interval, scratching a long scarlet parabola over the roof. She uses their noise to open the can. "Ee!" goes the shell. "Ding!" goes the brick onto the knife. The knife into the can. Dull, terrible detonation somewhere. Shell splinters zinging into the walls of a dozen houses. "Yee! Ding! Yee! Ding!" With each blow, a prayer, "Do not let him hear." 5 bashes, and it's leaking liquid. With the 6th, she manages to saw open a quadrant and bend up the lid with the blade of the knife. She raises it and drinks. Cool, salty, it is beans. Canned, cooked green beans. The water they have been boiled in is supremely tasty. Her whole body seems to reach up to absorb it. She empties the can. Inside her head, her father has gone quiet. The heads. Werner weaves the antenna through the rubbled ceiling and touches it to a twisted pipe. Nothing. On his hands and knees, he drags the aerial around the circumference of the cellar, as though roping Volkheimer into the golden armchair. Nothing. He switches off the dying flashlight and mashes the headset against his good ear and shuts his eyes against the darkness and turns on the repaired transceiver and runs the needle up and down the tuning coil, condensing all his senses into one. Static, 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 static. Maybe they are buried too deeply. Maybe the rubble of the hotel creates an electromagnetic shadow. Maybe something fundamental is broken in the radio that Werner has not identified. Or maybe the Fuhrer's super scientists have engineered a weapon to end all weapons, and this whole corner of Europe is a shattered waste, and Werner and Volkheimer are the only ones left. He takes off the headphones and breaks the connection. The rations are long gone, the canteens are empty, and the sludge in the bottom of the bucket full of paintbrushes is undrinkable. Both he and Volkheimer have gagged down several mouthfuls, and Werner is not sure he can stomach any more. The battery inside the radio is nearly dead. Once it's gone, they'll have the big American 11-volt with the black cat printed on the side. And then? How much oxygen does a person's respiratory system exchange for carbon dioxide every hour? There was a time when Werner would have loved to solve that puzzle. Now he sits with Volkheimer's 2 stick grenades in his lap, feeling the last bright things inside him fizzle out. Turning the shaft of one and then the other, he'd ignite their fuses just to light this place up, just to see again. Volkheimer has taken to switching on his field light and focusing its frail beam into the far corner where 8 or 9 white plaster heads stand on 2 shelves, several toppled onto their sides. They look like the heads of mannequins, only more skillfully fashioned. three with mustaches, two bald, one wearing the cap of a soldier. Even with the light off, the heads assume strange power in the dark, pure white, not quite visible, but not entirely invisible, embedded into Werner's retinas, almost glowing in the blackness, silent and watchful and unblinking, tricks of the mind, faces look away. In the blackness, he crawls towards Volkheimer, a comfort to find his friend's huge knee in the darkness, the rifle beside him, Baron's corpse somewhere beyond. Werner says, "Did you ever hear the stories they told about you?"
"Who?"
"The boys at Schulforta."
"F.U., I heard."
"Did you like it, being the giant, having everyone afraid of you?"
"It is not so fun being asked how tall you are all the time."
A shell detonates somewhere above ground. Somewhere out there the city burns, the sea breaks, barnacles beat their feathery arms.
"How tall are you?"
Volkheimer snorts once, a bark of a laugh.
"Do you think Bernd was right about the grenades?"
"No," says Volkheimer, his voice coming alert. "They would kill us."
"Even if we built some kind of barrier?"
"We'd be crushed."
Werner tries to make out the heads across the cellar in the blackness. If not the grenades, then what? Does Volkheimer really believe someone is going to come and save them? That they deserve saving?
"So we're just going to wait?"
Volkheimer doesn't answer.
"For how long?"
When the radio batteries die, the American 11-volt should run the transceiver for one more day, or he could wire the bulb from Volkheimer's field light to it. The battery will give them one more day of static, or one more day of light, but they will not need light to use the rifle. Delirium. A purple fringe flutters around von Rumpel's vision. Something must have gone wrong with the morphine. He may have taken too much, or else the disease has advanced far enough to alter his sight. Ash drifts through the window like snow. Is it dawn? The glow in the sky could be the light from fires. Sheets soaked in sweat, his uniform as wet as if he had been swimming in his sleep. Taste of blood in his mouth. He crawls to the end of the bed and looks at the model. He has studied every square inch of it, bashed a corner to pieces with the butt of a wine bottle. The structures in it are mostly hollow, the chateau, the cathedral, the market. But why bother to smash them all when one is missing, the very house he needs? Out in the forsaken city, every other structure, it seems, is burning or collapsing. But here in front of him, the inverse in miniature, the city remains, but the house he occupies is gone. Could the girl have carried it out with her when she fled? Possible. The uncle didn't have it when they sent him to Fort National. He was well searched. He carried nothing but his papers. Von Rumpel made sure of it. Somewhere a wall goes to pieces, 1,000 kilograms of masonry crashing down. That the house stands while so many others have been destroyed is evidence enough. The stone must be inside. He simply needs to find it while there is time. Clamp it to his heart and wait for the goddess to thrust her fiery hand through its planes and burn away his afflictions. Burn his way out of this citadel, out of this siege, out of this disease. He will be saved. He simply has to drag himself up from this bed and keep looking. Do it more methodically. As many hours as it takes, tear the place apart. Begin in the kitchen one more time. Water. Marie Laura hears the springs of her bed groan, hears the German limp out of her room and go down the stairs. Is he leaving? Giving up? It starts to rain. Thousands of tiny drops thrum onto the roof. Marie Laura stands in her tiptoes and presses her ear to the roofing beneath the slates, listens to the drops trickle down. What was the prayer? The one Madame Manek muttered to herself on Bastille Day as the fireworks went up. Lord our God, your grace is a purifying fire. She has to marshal her mind, use perception and logic, as her father would, as Jules Verne's great marine biologist Professor Pierre Arnaud Wood. The German does not know about the attic. She has the stone in her pocket. She has one can of food. These are advantages. The rain is good, too. It will stifle the fires. Could she capture some of it to drink, punch a hole in the slats, use it in some other way, maybe to cover her noise? She knows exactly where the two galvanized buckets are, just inside the door of her room. She can get to them. Maybe she can carry one back up. No, carrying it up would be impossible. Too heavy, too noisy. All that water sloshing everywhere. But she could go to one end and lower her face into it. She could fill the empty can of beans. The very thought of her lips against water, the tip of her nose touching its surface, summons a biological craving beyond anything she has experienced. In her mind, she falls into a lake. Water fills her ears and mouth. Her throat opens. One sip, and she could think more clearly. She waits for her father's voice in her head to raise an objection, but none comes. The distance through the front of the wardrobe, across Henri's room, across the landing, into her doorway, runs 21 paces, give or take. She takes the knife and the empty can from the floor and tucks them in her pocket. She creeps down the 7 ladder rungs and stays fixed for a long time against the back of the wardrobe, listening, listening, listening. The little wooden house is a bump against her ribs as she crouches. Inside its tiny attic, does some tiny likeness of Marie-Laure wait, listening? Does that tiny version of her feel this same thirst? The only sound is the patter of the rain turning Saint Malo into mud. Could be a trick. Maybe he heard her open the can of beans, went noisily downstairs, and climbed quietly back up. Maybe he stands outside the big wardrobe with his pistol drawn. Lord our God, your grace is a purifying fire. She flattens her hands against the back of the wardrobe and slides open the panel. The shirts drag across her face as she crawls through. She sets her hands against the inside of the wardrobe doors and nudges one open. No gunshot. Nothing. Out the now glassless window, the sound of rain falling on the burning houses is the sound of pebbles being stirred by waves. Marie-Laure steps onto the floor of her grandfather's old bedroom and summons him, a curious boy with lustrous hair who smells of the sea. He's playful, quick-witted, charged with energy. He takes one of her hands, while Etienne finds the other. The house becomes as it was 50 years ago. The boy's well-dressed parents laugh downstairs. A cook shucks oysters in the kitchen. Madame Manek, a young maid fresh from a countryside, sings on a stepladder as she dusts the chandelier. Papa, you had the keys to everything. The boys led her into the hall. She passes the bathroom. Traces of the German smell hang in her bedroom, an odor like vanilla. Beneath it, something putrid. She cannot hear anything beyond the rain outside and her own pulse discharging in her temples. She kneels as soundlessly as she can and runs her hands along the grooves of the floor. The sound of her fingertips striking the bucket side seems louder than the gong of a cathedral bell. Rain hums against the roof and walls, drips past the glassless window. All around her wait her pebbles and seashells. Her father's model, her quilt, somewhere in here must be her shoes. She lowers her face and touches her lips to the water's surface. Each swallow seems as loud as a shell burst. 1, 3, 5. She gulps breath, gulps breaths, her entire head inside the bucket, breathing, dying, dreaming. Does he stir? Is he downstairs? Is he coming back up? 9, 11, 13. She is full. Her whole gut stretches, sloshes. She has had too much. She slips the can into the bucket and lets it fill. Now to retreat without making a sound, without bumping a wall, the door, without tripping, without spilling. She turns and begins to crawl, the full can of water in her left hand. Marie Laura makes the doorway of her room before she hears him. He is 3 or 4 stories below, ransacking one of the rooms. She hears what sounds like a crate of ball bearings get dumped onto the floor. They bounce, clatter, and roll. She reaches out her right hand, and here, just inside of the doorway, she discovers something big and rectangular and hard, covered with cloth. Her book, the novel, sitting right here as though her father has placed it for her. The German must have tossed it off her bed. She lifts it as quietly as she can and holds it against the front of her uncle's coat. Can she make it downstairs? Can she slip past him and into the street? But already the water is filling her capillaries, improving the flow of her blood. Already she thinks more keenly. She does not want to die. Already she had risked too much. Even if she could miraculously slip past the German, there is no promise that the streets will be safer than the house. She makes it to the landing, makes it to the threshold of her grandfather's bedroom, feels her way to the wardrobe, climbs through the open doors, closes them gently behind her. The beams. Shells are careening overhead, quaking the cellar like passing freight trains. Werner imagines the American artillerymen, spotters with scopes balanced on rocks or tank treads or hotel railings, firing officers computing wind speed, barrel elevation, air temperature, radio men with telephone receivers pressed to their ears, calling in targets. Right, 3 degrees. Repeat, range. Calm, weary voices directing fire. The same sort of voice God uses, perhaps, when he calls souls to him. This way, please. Only numbers. Pure math. You have to accustom yourself to thinking that way. It's the same on their side, too.
My great-grandfather, Volkheimer says all of a sudden, was a sawyer in the years before steamships, when everything went by sail.
Werner can't be sure in the blackness, but he thinks Volkheimer is standing, running his fingertips along one of the 3 splintered beams that hold up the ceiling. His knees bent to accommodate his height, like Atlas about to slip into the traces.
Back then, Volkheimer says, all of Europe needed masts for their navies, but most of the countries had cut down their big trees. England, great-grandfather said, didn't have a tree worth its wood on the whole island, so the masts for the British and Spanish navies, the Portuguese too, would come from Prussia, from the woods where I grew up. Great-grandfather knew where all the giants were. Some of those trees could take a crew of 5 men 3 days to bring down. First the wedges would go in, like needles, he said, in the hide of an elephant. The biggest trunks would swallow 100 wedges before they'd creak. The artillery screams, the cellar shudders. Great-grandfather said he loved to imagine the big trees sledding behind teams of horses across Europe, across rivers, across the sea to Britain, where they'd be stripped and treated and raised up again as masts, where they'd see decades of battle, given a second life, sailing atop the great oceans until eventually they'd fall and die their second death. Another shell goes overhead, and Werner imagines he hears the wood in the huge beams above him splinter. That chunk of coal was once a green plant, a fern or reed that lived 1 million years ago, or maybe 2 million, or maybe 100 million. Can you imagine 100 million years? Werner says, where I'm from, they dig up trees, prehistoric ones.
Volkheimer says,
I was desperate to leave.
I was too.
And now?
Bernd molders in the corner. Jutta moves through the world somewhere, watching shadows disentangle themselves from night, watching miners limp past in the dawn. It was enough when Werner was a boy, wasn't it? A world of wildflowers blooming up through the shapes of rusty cast-off parts. A world of berries and carrot peels and Frau Elena's fairy tales.
of the sharp smell of tar and trains passing and bees humming in the window boxes. String and spit and wire and a voice on the radio offering a loom on which to spin his dreams. The transmitter. It waits on the table tucked against the chimney, the twin marine batteries below it. A strange machine built years before to talk to a ghost. As carefully as she can, Marie-Laure crawls to the piano bench and eases herself up. Someone must have a radio. The fire brigade, if one remains, or the resistance, or the Americans hurling missiles at the city, the Germans in their underground forts, maybe Etienne himself. She tries to imagine him hunched somewhere, his fingers twisting the dials of a phantom radio. Maybe he assumes she is dead. Maybe he needs only to hear a flicker of hope. She runs her fingers along the stones of the chimney until she finds the lever her uncle installed there. She presses her whole weight against on it, and the antenna makes a faint grating noise above the roof as it telescopes upward. Too loud. She waits, counts to 100. No sound from downstairs. Beneath the table, her fingers find switches, one for the microphone, the other for the transmitter. She cannot remember which is which. Switch on one, then the other. Inside the big transmitter, vacuum tubes thrum.
Is it too loud, Papa? No louder than the breeze, the undertone of the fires.
She traces the lines of the cables until she is sure she has the microphone in her hand. To shut your eyes is to guess nothing of blindness. Beneath your world of skies and faces and building exists a raw and older world, a place where surface planes disintegrate and sounds ribbon in shoals through the air. Marie-Laure can sit in an attic high above the street and hear lilies rustling in marshes 2 miles away. She hears Americans scurry across farm fields, directing their huge cannons at the smoke of St. Malo. She hears families sniffing around hurricane lamps in cellars, crows hopping from pile to pile, flies landing on corpses in ditches. She hears the tamarinds shiver and the jays shriek and the dune grass burn. She feels the great granite fist sunk deep into the earth's crust on which St. Malo sits, and the ocean teething at its from all four sides, and the outer islands holding steady against the swirling tides. She hears crows drink from stone troughs and dolphins rise through the green water of the channel. She hears the bones of dead whales stir 5 leagues below, their marrow offering a century of food for cities of creatures who will live their whole lives and never once see a photon sent from the sun. She hears her snails in the grotto drag their bodies over the rocks.
Rather than my reading it to you, maybe you could read it to me.
With her free hand, she opens the novel in her lap, finds the lines with her fingers, brings the microphone to her lips. Voice. On the morning of his fourth day, trapped beneath whatever is left of the Hotel of Bees, Werner is listening to the repaired transceiver, feathering the tuning knob back and forth, when a girl's voice says directly into his good ear,
"At 3 in the morning, I was awakened by a violent blow."
He thinks, "It's hunger, the fever. I'm imagining things. My mind is forcing the static to coalesce." She says,
"I sat up in bed and tried to hear what was going on, but suddenly I was hurled out into the middle of the room."
She speaks quiet, perfectly enunciated French. Her accent is crisper than Frau Elena's. He grinds the headphones onto his ear.
"Obviously," she says, "the Nautilus had collided with something and then heeled over at a sharp angle."
She rolls her R's, draws out her S's With each syllable, the voice seems to burrow a bit deeper into his brain. Young, high, hardly more than a whisper. If it is a hallucination, let it be.
One of these icebergs turned and struck the Nautilus as it was cruising underwater. The iceberg then slipped under its hull and lifted it with an irresistible force into shallower water.
He can hear her wet the top of her mouth with her tongue.
But who was to say that at that moment we would not collide against the underside of the barrier and thus be horribly squashed between two surfaces of ice?
The static emerges again, threatening to wash her out, and he tries desperately to fight it off. He is a child in his attic dormer, clinging to a dream he does not want to leave. But Jutta has laid a hand on his shoulder and is whispering him awake.
We were suspended in the water, but 10 meters on each side of the Nautilus rose a shining wall of ice. Above and below, there was the same wall.
She stops reading abruptly, and the static roars. When she speaks again, her voice has become an urgent hiss.
He is here. He is right below me.
Then the broadcast cuts out. He feathers the tuner, switches bands, nothing. He takes off the headset and moves in the total blackness toward where Volkheimer sits and grabs what he thinks is his arm.
I heard something, please.
Volkheimer does not move. He seems made of wood. Bernard yanks with all his strength, but he is too little, too weak. The strength deserts him almost as soon as it came.
Enough, comes Volkheimer's voice from the blackness. It won't do any good.
Bernard sits on the floor. Somewhere in the ruins above them, cats are howling, starving, as is he, as is Volkheimer. A boy at Schopforta once described for Werner a rally at Nuremberg, an ocean of banners and flags, he said, masses of boys teeming in the lights, and the Fuhrer himself on an altar a half a mile away, spotlights illuminating pillars behind him, the atmosphere oversaturated with meaning and anger and righteousness. Hans Schlitzer, crazy for it. Herbert Pomzel, crazy for it. Every boy at Schopforta, crazy for it. And the only person in Werner's life who could see through all that stagecraft was his younger sister. How? How did Jutta understand so much more about how the world worked, while he knew so little? But who was to say that at that moment we wouldn't collide against the underside of the barrier and thus be horribly squashed between two surfaces of ice? He is here. He is right below me. Do something. Save her. But God is only a white, cold eye, a quarter moon poised above the smoke, blinking, blinking as the city is gradually pounded to dust. 9. May 1944. Edge of the World. In the back of the Opel, Volkheimer reads aloud to Werner. The paper Jutta has written on seems little more than tissue in his gigantic paws.
Oh, and Herr Scheidler, the mining official, sent a note congratulating you on your successes. He says people are noticing. Does that mean you can come home? Hans Pfeffering says to tell you, a bullet fears the brave, although I maintain that's a bad advice. And Frau Elena's toothache is better now, but she can't smoke, which makes her cranky. Did I tell you she started smoking?
Over Volkheimer's shoulder, through the cracked rear window of the truck shell, Werner watches a red-haired child in a velvet cape float 6 feet above the road. She passes through trees and road signs, veers around curves. She is as inescapable as a moon. Newman 1 coaxes the Opel west, and Werner curls beneath the bench in the back and does not move for hours, bundled in a blanket, refusing tea, tinned meat, while the floating child pursues him through the countryside. Dead girl in the sky, dead girl out the window, dead girl 3 inches away. 2 wet eyes in that third eye, the bullet hole never blinking. They bounce through a string of small green towns where pollard trees line sleepy canals. A pair of women on bicycles pull off the road and gape at the truck as it passes, some infernal lorry sent to blight their town.
"France," says Bernd.
The canopies of cherry trees drift overhead, pregnant with blossoms. Berner props open the back door and dangles his feet off the rear bumper, his heels just above the flowing road. A horse rolls on its back in grass. 5 white clouds decorate the sky. They unload in a town called Epernay, and the hotel keeper brings wine and chicken legs and broth that Werner manages to keep down. People at the tables around them speak the language that Frau Elena whispered to him as a child. Newman I is sent to find Diesel, and Newman II engages Bernd in a debate about whether or not cow intestines were used as inflatable cells inside First War Zeppelins, and 3 boys in berets peer around a doorpost and ogle Volkheimer with huge eyes. Behind them, 6 flowering marigolds in the dusk form the shape of the dead girl, then become flowers once more. The hotel keeper says, "You would like more?" Werner cannot shake his head. Just now, he's afraid to set down his hands in case they pass right through the table. They drive all night and stop at dawn at a checkpoint on the northern rim of Brittany. The walled citadel of St. Malo blooms out of the distance. The clouds present diffuse bands of tender grays and blues, and below them the ocean does the same. Volkheimer shows their orders to a sentry. Without asking permission, Werner climbs out of the truck and slips over the low seawall onto the beach. He winds through a series of barricades and makes for the tide line. To his right runs a line of anti-invasion obstacles shaped like child's jacks, strung with razor wire, extending at least a mile down the shoreline. No footprints in the sand. Pebbles and bits of weed are strung in scallop lines. A trio of outer islands bear low stone forts. A green lantern glows on the tip of a jetty. It feels appropriate somehow to have reached the edge of the continent, to have only the hammered sea left in front of him, as though this is the endpoint Werner has been moving toward ever since he left Zollverein. He dips a hand in the water and puts his fingers in his mouth to taste the salt. Someone is shouting his name, but Werner does not turn. He would like nothing more than to stand here all morning and watch the swells move under the light. They're screaming now, Bernd, then Newman I, and finally Werner turns to see them waving, and he picks his way along the sand and back up through the lines of razor wire toward the opal. 12 people watch, sentries, a handful of townspeople, many with hands over their mouths.
"Tread carefully, boy," Bernd is yelling. "There are mines. Didn't you read the signs?"
Werner climbs into the back of the truck and crosses his arms.
"Have you completely lost it?" asks Newman II.
The few souls they see inside the old city press their backs up against walls to allow the battered opal to pass. Newman I stops outside a 4-story house with pale blue shutters.
"Die Kriegskommandantur," he announces.
Volkheimer goes inside and returns with a colonel in field uniform, the Reichswehr coat and high belt and tall black boots. On his heels come 2 aides.
"We believe there is a network of them," one aide says. "The encoded numbers are followed by announcements, births, and baptisms, and engagements and deaths."
"Then there is music, almost always music," says the second. "What it means, we cannot say."
The colonel drags 2 fingers along his perfect jawline. Volkheimer gazes at him, and then his aides, as though assuring worried children that some injustice will be righted.
"We'll find them," he says. "It won't take long."
Numbers. Reinhold von Rumpel visits a doctor in Nuremberg. The tumor in the sergeant major's throat, reports the doctor, has grown to 4 centimeters in diameter. The tumor in the small intestine is harder to measure.
3 months, says the doctor. Maybe 4.
An hour later, von Rumpel has installed himself at a dinner party. 4 months, 120 sunrises, 120 more times he has to drag his corrupted body out of a bed and button it into a uniform. The officers at the table talk with indignation about other numbers. The 8th and 5th German armies retreat north through Italy. The 10th Army might be encircled. Rome could be lost. How many men? 100,000. How many vehicles? 20,000. Liver is served, cubes of it with salt and pepper, showered in a rain of purple gravy. When the plates are taken away, von Rumpel hasn't touched his. 3,400 marks, all he has left, and 3 tiny diamonds that he keeps in an envelope inside his billfold, each perhaps a carat. A woman at the table enthuses about greyhound racing, the speed, the charge she feels watching it. Von Rumpel reaches for the looped handle of his coffee cup, tries to hide the shaking. A waiter touches his arm.
Call for you, sir, from France.
Von Rumpel walks on wobbly legs through a swinging door. The waiter sets a telephone on a table and retreats.
Sergeant Major, this is Jean Brignon.
The name conjures nothing in Von Rumpel's memory.
I have information about the locksmith whom you asked about last year.
Leblanc.
Yes, Daniel Leblanc. But my cousin, sir, do you remember? You offered to help. You said that if I found information, you could help him.
3 couriers, 2 found, 1 last puzzle to solve. Von Rumpel dreams of the goddess almost every night. Hair made of flames, fingers made of roots. Madness. Even as he stands at the telephone, ivy twines around his neck, climbs into his ears.
Yes, your cousin. What have you discovered?
Leblanc was accused of conspiracy, something to do with a chateau in Brittany. Arrested in January 1941 on a tip from a local. They found drawings, skeleton keys. He was also photographed taking measurements in St. Malo.
A camp?
I have not been able to find out. The system is rather elaborate.
What about the informer?
A Malouin named Lafitte. First name, Claude.
Von Rumpel thinks the blind daughter, the flat on Rue des Patriarches, vacant since June 1940, while the Natural History Museum pays the rent. Where would you run if you had to run somewhere, if you had something valuable to carry, with a blind daughter in tow? Why St. Malo unless someone you trusted lived there?
My cousin, Jean Brignon, is saying, you'll help.
Thank you very much,
says von Rumpel, and sets the receiver back in its cradle. May. The last days of May 1944 in St. Malo feel to Marie-Laure like the last days of May 1940 in Paris, huge and swollen and redolent, as if every living thing rushes to establish a foothold before some cataclysm arrives. The air on the way to Madame Rouet's bakery smells of myrtle and magnolia and verbena. Wisteria vines erupt in blossom. Everywhere hang arcades and curtains and pendants of flowers. She counts storm drains. At 21, she passes the butcher, the sound of a hose splashing onto tile. At 25, she is at the bakery. She places a ration coupon on the counter.
One ordinary loaf, please.
And how is your uncle?
The words are the same, but the voice of Madame Rouel is different, galvanized.
My uncle is well, thank you.
Madame Rouel does something she has never done. She reaches across the counter and cups Marie-Laure's face in her flowery palms.
You amazing child. Are you crying, madame? Is everything all right? Everything is wonderful, Marie-Laure.
The hands withdraw. The loaf comes to her, heavy, warm, larger than normal.
Tell your uncle that the hour has come, that the mermaids have bleached hair.
The mermaids, madame?
They are coming, dear. Within the week, put out your hands.
From across the counter comes a wet, cool cabbage as big as a cannonball. Marie-Laure can hardly fit it into the mouth of her knapsack.
Thank you, madame.
Now get home.
Is it clear ahead?
As water from the rock. Nothing in your way. Today is a beautiful day, a day to remember.
The hour has come.
Les serins ont les chevaux de colores.
Her uncle has been hearing rumors on his radio that across the channel, in England, a tremendous armada is gathering, ship after ship being requisitioned, fishing vessels and ferries retrofitted, equipped with weapons, 5,000 boats, 11,000 airplanes, 50,000 vehicles. At the intersection with the Rue d'Estrée, she turns not left toward home, but right, 50 meters to the ramparts, 100 or so more along the base of the walls. From her pocket, she pulls Harold Bazin's iron key. The beaches have been closed for several months, studded with mines and walled off with razor wire. But here, in the old kennel, out of sight of everyone, Marie-Laure can sit among her snails and dream herself into the mind of the great marine biologist Arnaud. Both guest of honor and prisoner on Captain Nemo's great machine of curiosity, free of nations and politics, cruising through the kaleidoscopic wonders of the sea. Oh, to be free, to lie once more in the Jardin des Plantes with Papa, to feel his hands on hers, to hear the petals of the tulips tremble in the wind. He made her the glowing hot center of his life. He made her feel as if every step she took was important.
Are you still there, Papa?
They are coming, dear, within the week.
Hunting again. They search day and night. Saint-Malo, Dinard, Saint-Servin, Saint-Vincent. Newman One coaxes the battered opal down streets so narrow that the sides of the truck shell scrape against the walls. They pass little gray creperies with their windows smashed and shuttered bougleries and empty bistros and hillsides full of conscripted Russians pouring cement and heavy-boned prostitutes carrying water from wells, and they find no broadcasts of the sort the colonel's aides described. Werner can receive the BBC from the north and propaganda stations from the south. Sometimes he manages to snare random flits of Morse code, but he hears no birth or wedding or death announcements, no numbers, no music. The room Werner and Bernd are given on the top floor of a requisitioned hotel in the city within the walls is like a place that time wants no part of. 300-year-old stucco quadrifoils and palmate capitals and spiraling horns of fruit festoon the ceiling. At night, the dead girl from Vienna strides the halls. She does not look at Werner as she passes his open door, but he knows it is he she is hunting. The hotel keeper wrings his hands while Volkheimer paces the lobby. Airplanes crawl across the sky, seems to Werner incredibly slow, as if at any moment one will stall and drop into the sea.
Us? Asks Newman One. Or this?
Do I to tell?
Werner walks the upstairs corridors. On the top floor, in what is perhaps the hotel's nicest room, he stands in a hexagonal bathtub and wipes grime off a window with the heel of his palm. A few airborne seeds swirl in the wind, then drop into the chasm of shadow between houses. Above him in the dimness, a 9-foot-long queen bee, with multiple eyes and golden fuzz on her abdomen, curls across the ceiling. Dear Jutta, sorry I have not written these past months. The fever is mostly gone now, and you should not worry. I have been feeling very clear-headed lately, and what I want to write about today is the sea. It contains so many colors, silver at dawn, green at noon, dark blue in the evening. Sometimes it looks almost red, or it will turn the color of old coins. Right now, the shadows of clouds are dragging across it, and patches of sunlight are touching down everywhere. White strings of gulls drag over it like beads. It is my favorite thing, I think, that I have ever seen. Sometimes I catch myself staring at it and forget my duties. It seems big enough to contain everything anyone could ever feel. Say hello to Frau Elena and the children who are left. Claire de Lune. Tonight they work a section of the old city tucked against the southern ramparts. Rain falls so lightly that it seems indistinguishable from fog. Werner sits in the back of the Opel. Volkheimer drowses on the bench beside him. Bernd is up on the parapet with the first transceiver under a poncho. He has not keyed his handset in hours, which means he is asleep. The only light comes from the amber filament inside Werner's signal meter. The spectrum is all static, and then it is not. Madame Labos sends word that her daughter is pregnant. Monsieur Ferry sends love to his cousins at Saint-Vincent. A great gust of static shears past. The voice is like something from a long-ago dream. A half-dozen more words flutter through Werner in that Breton accent. Next broadcast Thursday, 2300, 5672-something. Memory coming at Werner like a six-car train out of the darkness. The quality of the transmission and the tenor of the voice matching in every respect the broadcasts of the Frenchman he used to hear, and then a piano plays three single notes, followed by a pair, the chords rising peacefully, each a candle leading deeper into a forest. The recognition is immediate. It is as if he has been drowning for as long as he can remember, and somebody has fetched him up for air. Just behind Werner, Volkheimer's eyelids remain closed. Through the separator between the shell and cab, he can see the motionless shoulders of the Newmans. Werner covers the meter with his hand. The song unspools, grows louder, and he waits for Bernd to key his microphone to say he has heard. But nothing comes. Everyone is asleep. And yet, hasn't the little shell in which he and Volkheimer sit gone electric? Now the piano makes a long, familiar run, the pianist playing different scales with each hand, what sounds like three hands, four, the harmonies like steadily thickening pearls on a strand, and Werner sees six-year-old Jutta lean toward him, Frau Elena kneading bread in the background, a crystal radio in his lap, the chords of his soul not yet severed. The piano rills through its finishing measures, and then the static wallops back. Did they hear? Can they hear his heart hammering right now against his ribs? There's the rain falling lightly past the high houses. There's Volkheimer, his chin resting on the acreage of his chest. Friedrich said, "We don't have choices, don't own our lives." But in the end, it was Werner who pretended there were no choices. Werner, who watched Friedrich dump the pail of water at his feet. "I will not." Werner, who stood by as the consequences came raining down. Werner, who watched Volkheimer wade into house after house, the same ravening nightmare recurring over and over and over. He removes the headset and eases past Volkheimer to open the back door. Volkheimer opens one eye, huge, golden, lion-like. He says, "Nix." Werner looks up at the stone houses arrayed wall to wall, tall and aloof, their faces damp, their windows dark, no lamplight anywhere, no antennas. The rain falls so softly, almost soundlessly, but to Werner it roars. He turns, Next, he says, nothing.
Well, we've come to the end of the book hour in today's reading of All the Light We Cannot See by Anthony Doerr. Preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.